you this evening. Good. As we get started, I don't know if the group from Broken Arrow are online yet or if there's a way to tell if they're online yet or not. I just want to give a shout out to my dear friend, Nathan Davis. Hello to you and to your group there. And I am just so stoked that you're participating with us in this event via the magic of the internet. That's super cool. And whoever else is watching out there, I want to welcome you as well. Tonight's first topic is If God Is So Good. And where this title comes from is about halfway across the country in this Jesus dialogue that I was having with my dear friend in first class. He finally had arrived at this idea of, okay, maybe there was a Jesus, maybe Jesus did, you know, teach an ethic that is of relevance to us today. But then he switched from the ethical view of Jesus to the cosmological view of Jesus rather quickly. And he says, well, then just tell me this. Let's say Jesus is as good as he is. Well, if there's a good God out there, he said, and God is so good, and God looks like that Jesus, he says, then why is the suck factor of my life so high? Can anyone identify with the question he's asking? Amen, brother. If God is so good, if there is a God out there, and this is a question that theists have to wrestle with, it is not a question that troubles the agnostic or the atheist. It is only a question for the theist. If you believe there is a God out there, and you believe that that God is good, it produces the philosophical question of then why is life on this planet look so bad? The Hebrews, in their tradition, during the time of Jesus' ministry, they believed that suffering was a result of divine punishment. Their big question was not why is there suffering. It was, why is there a disparity in human suffering? In other words, they were asking the question, why do good people suffer and bad people seem to have a great life? Anyone identify with that question? Well, it's rooted again in the idea, in the thought, the explanation for suffering as being a punishment from God. And I bring this up because anytime you talk about Jesus, the question of theos and of a good God and of human suffering also eventually surfaces, as it did in our conversation that day on the plane. But I want to be very clear, the Jesus narrative, the Jesus story, is not a story that deals with human suffering ontologically, cosmologically, or epistemologically. It doesn't deal with giving us an answer for the why. And I'll explain to you why I believe that. Look at John 9, 2 through 3. This is John's gospel. And John starts off right in the beginning. His disciples asked him, "Teacher, whose sin caused him to be born blind?" They're referring to a gentleman who's suffering from blindness. And notice their worldview again. It's a very Hebraic, first century Judaistic worldview. If you sin, God will punish you. If you obey, God will reward you. If someone's suffering, remember what we said last night, somebody somewhere must have what? But this guy was born blind. So that produces another problem. Who sinned? If he was born that way, was it him? How do you explain that? Or was it his parents? And I want you to notice Jesus' response. Jesus says what? What's the word he uses there? Neither. Talk to me now.
Neither.
Neither. Wrong explanation for human suffering. Neither did this man sin nor his parents. Rather, let the works of God be manifest in him. Jesus was more focused. There are certain things we can deduce from the Jesus story, but Jesus was more focused on bringing human suffering to an end rather than philosophically explaining why human suffering exists. Now, for those of you who want an answer, the Jesus story is going to frustrate you. I'm just going to be honest. Be very transparent. You're not going to find your answer to the why. Jesus did challenge the answers to the why that were in existence in his day. One of them is problematic for us because the answer the Hebrews had derived and was in their sacred text was that it's a punishment. How many can see that the punishment answer, even though there are Old Testament passages that communicate the reason for human suffering being divine punishment, how many of you can see that divine punishment is not a significant, it's not a, it doesn't do the subject justice. It's not a good enough answer. How many can see that? It's not a good, there are people out there, number one, that could not have sinned enough to suffer, to deserve what they're going through. Anyone here agree with that? The second problem is that it doesn't line up with reality. Even though it's biblical, it doesn't line up with reality. I spent some time in New Orleans a few years back. I was doing a series of meetings in that area, and I scheduled a couple days afterwards to go on some historical tours. I wanted to see the flood damage there in New Orleans, and you can judge me later, but I even scheduled some tours of the French Quarter and that area. I went during the day, so don't freak out. But one thing I noticed is that during the flooding of New Orleans, something that good fundamentalist Christians in the South were saying is that it was a punishment from who? A divine judgment, mind you, on that city for its gross immorality. How many heard that kind of, you remember hearing that kind of rhetoric during the time of the, yes. Here's the problem with that. Do you know which section, if that's true, do you know which section of New Orleans is built upon the highest elevation of the entire city? Do you know which section of New Orleans, specifically which street in New Orleans, is on the highest point of... Do you know which section received, out of all the flood damage that New Orleans suffered, do you know which section of New Orleans received zero flood damage? The French Quarter, specifically Bourbon Street. So I would submit to you that if human suffering is a punishment, a divine punishment from God because of gross immorality as we define it, and the French Quarter received zero flood damage, God missed. It doesn't line up with reality. I find encouragement in the fact that Jesus rejected this kind of logic. First thing that we can deduce from the Jesus story is not why there is human suffering, but we can deduce at least, number one, why there isn't. Why, in other words, we can deduce why... What's the word I'm looking for? We can derive from the Jesus story an explanation that doesn't work. In other words, the idea that it's a divine punishment, we can deduce from it at least that that's not the answer. Number two, some will say, well, it's God's will. Everything happens for a reason. How many have heard that before? Nothing happens without omnipotence willing it to happen, some will say. Some well-meaning Christians will say providence writes straight with crooked lines. If you could see it from his perspective, you would see that from God's perspective, you would see that this is a blessing, not a... How many have heard that kind of rhetoric before? Everything happens according to God's plan. And that sells a lot of books, but it also creates non-theists. Luke 7, verse 30, we can at least deduce this. But the Pharisees and the lawyers rejected the what? So according to the Jesus narrative, is it possible for human beings to reject God's will? And I want to be very careful here too. Some people will call that free will. Academically, there's no such thing as free will. How many realize that? No, that's a new thought for you? I believe you have the ability to make decisions. How many would agree with that? But have you ever made any decisions where your will was in a vacuum, not being influenced by something? That's what free will means. Now, don't misunderstand me. What we typically mean by free will, I agree with. But technically, you have never made a decision ever with all of the information. Am I right? Am I right? You've never made a decision without some kind of guesswork taking place. Am I right? That's or at least some influence taking place. It might have been a moldy piece of cheese, as Ebenezer Scrooge would say. But we've never made decisions in a vacuum. So outside of the debate that rages right now over whether free will exists or not, what we can know is that God has at least, in the Jesus story, the God of the Jesus story, has at least, in the story, given people the ability to say no to that God. If you can see that, say yes. So there's freedom in the story, at least for that. Look at Luke 13:34. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets, stone those that sent you. How often I have longed to gather your children together as hens gather her chicks under her wings. But what's the problem? It wasn't your will. Is that what he says? It wasn't God's will for that to happen. Is that what it says? No, it's not that it wasn't God's will. It wasn't whose will? It wasn't theirs. You were not willing. Now, again, I think there are some types of human suffering that even this doesn't solve. Just human freedoms doesn't solve. How many would agree with me? There's still some. And that's the challenge of the topic. When you're looking at it ontologically, or you're looking at it metaphysically or philosophically, what's frustrating about this topic is every time you get an answer, right behind that answer is another question. How many have noticed that? And so you get that question answered, and right behind that answer is another question. And you get that question answered, and right behind that answer is another question. And I'm sorry to have to say this tonight, but in this life, on a philosophical level, the questions went out. There are more questions when it comes to this topic than there are answers, and it may be beneficial for us to at least start being honest about that. What I find great comfort in is that the Jesus story may not give me answers to the whys of human suffering, but it does give me ways, methods, it gives me a path whereby which I can participate in alleviating and bringing an end to human suffering. Do you see the difference between the two? This is a story that shows us a path, not an explanation. And I know that'll be disappointing for some who need an explanation. I wish I had more to give you. Look at Matthew 6, verse 10. Jesus, this is what Christians call the Lord's Prayer. This is probably the most famous prayer in the Gospels. It is the most famous prayer in the Gospels. And Jesus teaches his disciples here to pray, "Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." Here's my question to the theists that say everything happens according to God's will. If everything's happening according to God's will, why is Jesus, especially Christians who say this, why is your Jesus asking us to pray for God's will to take place if it already is taking place? How many can see the contradiction there between that? So at least we can deduce that human suffering is not the will of God, at least the God of the Jesus story. We can't look at human suffering and pacify ourselves by saying, well, everything happens for a reason, or God's ways aren't our ways. This type of rhetoric, it doesn't find root in the Jesus story. Jesus never looked at someone suffering and said, that must be God's will. He saw human suffering as an enemy agent that he was going to seek to bring either alleviation or reversal to. He didn't seek to explain it. He sought to reverse it. Let's talk about this for a moment. What we can also derive from the Jesus story about human suffering challenges these ideas that there's a God out there that can do anything that God wants. In John 5:19, Jesus said, "Very truly I tell you, the Son of Man can do nothing but only what he sees the Father doing. That was his term for his God, the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, the Son does likewise. The context here is that Jesus has just healed a cripple who had been a cripple from infancy. He has just healed a paralytic who couldn't walk. And the reason he justifies him doing this, even though it's on the Jewish Sabbath day, which they said you can't heal on, the reason he justifies this is because he had a picture of his God that said that was God's will. Are you with me? So he didn't say this was God, what God's will, number one. He saw that God was working to alleviate this suffering, and so he participated in that and brought healing. But there's something else we can derive from this. Notice in Mark 8, he's saying Jesus is claiming by self-proclamation to be mimicking the type of God he envisions. And in Mark 8, it says, they came to Bethsaida, and some of the people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he had, by the way, I know that in this series I'm going to be telling you that Jesus is your example, but in most things, Jesus is your example, not in this instance right here. If someone comes to you for help, do not spit in their eye. It says, when Jesus had spit on the man's eyes, and we can talk about the cultural significance of that later, and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, do you see anything? And this is fascinating. He looked up and said, I see people. They look like trees walking around. Now watch what happens. So once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Now maybe you're not realizing why this story is so precious to this topic. Has anyone ever found courage in this story that even Jesus, had to pray twice? Think about what that implies. Some who say that everything happens according to God's will, was it not God's will to heal him the first time? How many can see that would produce problems? Because there was Jesus saying, this is what I see, this is my picture of God and how I'm relating to it, and he sought to heal him. Some Christians will say, well, maybe there's not enough faith. Do you really want to say that Jesus didn't have enough faith the first time he prayed? That's problematic, isn't it? What we can deduce from this is whatever your reason for human suffering that you believe why human suffering's out there, Jesus engages human suffering not as some fruit of divine will, but as something that he must engage in a formidable struggle. It is difficult even for Jesus to bring the reversal of human suffering, and he claims that it's something that's difficult even for his God. Now, we have, again, a very Greek idea of God in Western Christianity today that says God can just do anything he wants. A story like this fundamentally challenges that picture of a God, that theology, that theos. By painting the picture of a God working through Jesus in something that's even challenging for Jesus' God. Jesus says, if you've seen me, you've seen who? The Father. Jesus said, I only do what I see the Father doing. So Jesus is engaged in this healing work, and yet he keeps bumping up against obstacles, which actually fits reality. How many would agree that it is always right to try and stop human suffering? How many would agree with that? Is it always possible? No. Is it always a challenge? Does it take wisdom? Does it take effort? Yeah. And that's the kind of picture we get from the Jesus story. Matthew 13, 54 says, coming to his hometown, he began teaching the people in the synagogue there. And it says they took offense at him, which, you know, isn't surprising. Some of the things Jesus taught were offensive. But this is specifically offensive because it's his hometown. And it says, and he did not do any miracles there because of their what? Now, don't look at this as a faith meter. In other words, the qualitative, you know, they didn't have enough faith, so Jesus couldn't do it. No, it was because of their rejection of Jesus. I've been in churches where I've sensed a lot of openness and support for Jesus, and it's very easy to you can accomplish a lot in those types of environments. I've been in churches where I've been told ahead of time that I'm on probation. And in those, you're being very careful and you're walking on eggshells. And in those churches, the flat out truth is you're just not able to accomplish as much because you're not able to say as much. Does that make sense? This is what Jesus is bumping up against in his hometown. Did Jesus go to his hometown and say, well, I would do the miracles here that I've done everywhere else, but for some good reason, and one day you'll understand, I choose not to. Is that what was happening? Or did Jesus want to do the same miracles in his hometown that he had done everywhere else, but something prevented him from being able to? Do you see the two different dynamics? And Jesus seemed to say that this is the dynamic that really, if you are a theist and you embrace a theism that reflects the God of Jesus, this is your picture of God, that God longs to solve human suffering and sometimes can and sometimes can't, but is always at work as the liberator of human suffering. Look at the next event in the Jesus story, Mark 9, 29. He replied, this kind can come out only by prayer. The context here is that a father had brought to the disciples of Jesus a demon-possessed child, that father's son, and the disciples had prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed and couldn't do it. Tried and tried and tried and couldn't do it. And Jesus comes down and does it like this, and he seems to indicate that the reason is that the reason that they were struggling and he wasn't is because of, this is a bizarre statement for bizarre part of the story for a postmodern naturalistic worldview. And this is dealing with the cosmology of that era, that context, that culture. But he seemed to indicate that there were certain kinds of demons that were more difficult to cast out than others. How many can at least see in the story that there is a formidable struggle taking place where some events are more challenging than others? Now, whether you are someone here tonight that believes in demonology, in other words, you believe there are demons running around out there, or whether you subscribe to the idea that this generation was trying to explain things that they didn't understand in the best way that they knew possible, regardless of where you are on how you explain this story, what we can both derive from this story is that some human sufferings are more challenging to fix than other human sufferings, even for Jesus. John 16:33. I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have what? I have met a lot of Christians in my life that cherish Bible promises, is what they call them. They'll write them down. They'll put them on their steering wheel, or they'll put them on the refrigerator, or they'll put them different places. I have yet to meet a Christian really into Bible promises that has written this one on a 3.5 card and taped it somewhere. But this is a promise from Jesus. You in this world will have trouble. One of the reasons is because there are more wills involved on this planet than just the gods of the Jesus story. That God's will. Another reason is because Jesus seems to paint that God as being non-coercive. But yet you've got still aspects of human suffering that even those answers don't answer. What I'm trying to get at through these tidbits of the Jesus story is, if you're someone for whom the why of human suffering is a big ticket item tonight, the Jesus story can at least help us start asking the right questions. If we take the story seriously, the story is telling us that the question shouldn't be, why does a God intervene here and why doesn't a God intervene over here? The question we should be asking is, why can a God intervene over here and why can't a God intervene over here? And those are two different sets of questions. Not whether you agree with those questions, but how many will agree that those are at least two different sets of questions? Those are two different implications there. A lot of this is rooted in the Hebrew narrative too of the book of Daniel, which was a very popular book in Jesus' day. It was, regardless of where you land on when the book of Daniel was written, it had implications for an oppressed people who, under the thumb of Rome, that were longing for liberation. It had been used in the Seleucid attacks against Israel. And it was cherished by some of the revolutionaries in Jesus' day as well. And there's an interesting story, another bizarre story in Daniel chapter 10. Look over in the gray section. It says, "Then he said to me, 'Do not be afraid, Daniel, but from the first day that you set your heart on understanding this and on humbling yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to your words.'" The problem is, this angel is saying, "Daniel, you've been praying, and I came as soon as you started praying." But in the context that I haven't included that part of the story for the sake of space. But if you go back to Daniel chapter 10, does anyone here know how long Daniel had been praying for? 3 weeks. How many days is 3 weeks? 21 days. What I find fascinating is that it says, "I came in response to your words, but the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for how long? 21 days. Now, whatever you make of this story, again, you can derive the point that the angel was sent on which day? And yet it took him 21 days to finally answer Daniel's prayer. And the angel doesn't show up and say, "Hey, it was God's will for me to wait this long." And I doubt that the angel stopped at Starbucks on the way and it just took him longer. I think what the story is intimating, regardless of whether you subscribe to the worldview that story is couched in, what the story is intimating is that sometimes God wants things and sometimes it takes even God time to pull things off. For whatever reason. The four answers that we typically get from the world's major religions to this question. Talk about the religion of Islam for a moment. I'm not critiquing the religion of Islam. I am not saying anything negative against it. I have a lot of good Muslim friends that are devout and are doing better work towards social justice than some of my even Christian friends. So I have a lot of respect for my Muslim brothers and sisters. But one of the answers that the religion of Islam gives is that it's disrespectful to ask why there's human suffering. In other words, it's disrespectful to question Allah, the will of Allah. It's blasphemous to even ask the question, why is there human suffering? How many have bumped into that answer, by the way, in Christianity as well? It's wrong to even ask why. I'm not saying it's wrong to ask why. I'm just telling you the Jesus story doesn't answer it. What the Jesus story does do is give us a way to alleviate human suffering, not explain to us the metaphysical reason why it exists. The Hindu answer, and before we judge too quickly, listen perceptively. The Hindu answer says if someone's suffering, it's their fault because they must have done something wrong in a previous life. That's called reincarnation. So ultimately, the answer for them is, if someone's suffering, whose fault is it? Theirs. Let's not critique that too hard, because how many have heard that answer in Christianity before? We don't say in a previous life, we say in this life, somewhere. Buddhism gives the answer It's just perception. There's no such thing as evil. There's no such thing as suffering. It's just how you're perceiving it. How many have heard that from Christianity before? If you could see this from God's perspective. And I've listed number four because number four seems to Christianity, the fourth world religion that we're looking at here, Christianity seems to be a hybrid of all the three answers we previously looked at. Depending upon which Christian you're talking to today, you will either get the Buddhist, Muslim, or Hindu answer to human suffering. The Jesus story gives us a radically different answer to human suffering than, or at least a contradictory picture of human suffering than all of the world's four major religions today. And I think that is significant for us to wrestle with in this series. Number one, as we've covered tonight, the Jesus story intimates that human suffering is not a punishment from God. How many are thankful for that? Jesus rejected that idea. Now, you may have a Bible verse that you say, but the Bible teaches that. Well, Judaism did too, had those same verses. And Jesus rejected that as an explanation for human suffering. The second thing we can deduce from what we've looked at is that not everything happens is the will of a divine being. How many are thankful for that this evening? And number three, what we can derive from the Jesus story is that preventing, healing, or stopping human suffering is always good. If you agree with that, say yes. But it is not always easy. If you can agree with that, say yes. Someone that I've been shaped by in my life is the scholar and theologian James H. Cone. For those of you who don't know who James Cone was, James Cone is the figurehead. He's not the father, but he's the figurehead for Black liberation theology here in America. And he makes some interesting statements about human suffering that I want to share with you this evening. It's in your grace section. It says, "The more I believed in God, the harder it became to sustain my faith." Has anyone ever been in that situation before? In the context of human suffering, the more you took the idea of a good God literally, the harder it became when you looked at human suffering to believe in a God that looks like that. How many have ever been in that predicament with James? And this was James's struggle. He said, "White supremacy was so pervasive that everywhere I went, it was there staring me in the face. In the North as well as the South, if God loves black people," James says, "then why do we suffer so much?" I'll tell you why. Well, maybe that's too brazen. No, I think it deserves to be honest. Because of white Christians here in America. That was my question as a child, and that is my question still. The Christian gospel, watch this, is more than a transcendent reality, more than going to heaven when I die to shout salvation as I fly. It is also an imminent reality, a powerful, watch this, liberating presence among the poor right now in their midst, building them up where they are torn down, propping them up on every leaning side. The gospel is found wherever poor people struggle for justice, fighting for their right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Benji Jenkins claims that Jesus won't fail you. And notice the context. That was made in the heat of the struggle for civil rights in Mississippi. Believing in Jesus is not an easy answer to human suffering. How many are thankful for that this evening? It's not a pie in the sky. Everything's okay and it's all explainable. Following Jesus isn't about having a great answer for why people suffer. Following Jesus is about participating in the way that Jesus taught to bring human suffering to an end. It's a liberating force, a deliverance force. James goes on to say, such faith gave her strength and courage to fight for justice against overwhelming odds. The Jesus story doesn't answer the why. It gives you the courage and the strength to fight against overwhelming odds. Without concrete signs of divine presence in the lives of the poor, the gospel becomes simply an opiate rather than liberating the powerless from humiliation and suffering. The gospel becomes a drug that helps them adjust to this world by looking for pie in the sky. How many have seen religion used to placate the suffering that are being oppressed? It's been used by those at the tops of the pyramids to keep those at the bottom anesthetized, looking for post-mortem blessing and just being content with what they're going through today. How many have seen religion used like that before? That is not what we're doing with the Jesus story in this series. Jesus gives us a way to restore those on both sides of human suffering, those that are causing it and those that are being the recipients of it. He gives us a way that is different from most revolutions, because most revolutions just replace oppressive regimes with another oppressive regime by a different name. It just flips it. Jesus gave us a way to dismantle the whole mess and to move toward a different world. So I contrast for you tonight. I know that typically when we talk about this topic, we're looking for an answer to the why. If you agree with that, say yes. Somebody tell me why people hurt. Why am I hurting? If God's so good. That is a very Hellenistic question to ask, and it's not bad. It's just a philosophical question. In the Jesus story, Jesus did very little going around explaining to people how the world operates and why it operates the way it does. He spent the lion's share of his time, instead of explaining things, trying to change things. In John 9, as we began tonight, remember, the disciples begin by asking the question, why? Who sinned, the guy or his parents? And Jesus had the opportunity there to give the answer of why. And instead he said what? He said neither. Let's just go to work at trying to alleviate this suffering rather than sitting back passively and talking about it. We are too content with answers to these questions when we should be allowing those questions to empower us to go out and bring an end to human suffering. And I have a hunch that if more Jesus followers were bringing an end to human suffering rather than debating why it exists, there would be less questions as to why it exists, and it would be easier for people to believe that there may be a God out there who is at work trying to bring human suffering to an end. So that's what it means to participate with Jesus. It doesn't mean you have, how many are thankful for that? It doesn't mean you have a slick philosophical answer to all the world's problems. How many are thankful for that? What it does do is show you a way to start alleviating the pain and the suffering that grips the majority of the inhabitants on this planet. It's not a why as much as it is a how. It's not why it's here, it's how can we stop, how can we bring it to an end? And it does give us hope, because it's not an endless dream. It's not a dream without some concrete assurance. It isn't, well, you can try, but no one's ever going to be able to pull it off. It's not that. The end of the story is that there was coming a day in Revelation 21:4 where He will wipe away how many tears? Every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain. How many are thankful that that's the end of the story? For the old order of things has what? The challenge is that some of us are sitting around waiting for Him to come and do this. And that's not why this is here. The story is told of the old stonemasons in Europe who built the beautiful cathedrals. You would have the stonemasons that would be assigned a specific job, and then you would have a master mason over all of the stonemasons. the master mason would assign each under mason a specific rock, a specific stone with specific instructions on what they were, how much was to be cut off here, how much was to be, what angle it was to have over here. And their only responsibility was to work on the rock that was in front of them. That's all they were to do. They didn't have to understand how it would fit into the end process. They didn't have to understand the big picture. All they needed to do was focus on shaping the rock in front of them. And when the master mason would come at the end of all of the shaping of the various and different stones, what the master mason would do is he would come around and gather up all of these rocks and form them into a beautiful cathedral. And if the mason was lucky enough, he could find the stone that he actually worked on and see how it fit in the beautiful structure. What would have happened if the masons just sat around and said, well, when the master comes, he'll build the cathedral? No, it took both, did it not? They were to participate in the work that led up to the enabling of the mason to finish it. And I don't know, I'm being transparent with you tonight, I don't know how heaven and earth are going to be reunited again. I don't know the big picture, how that's all going to play out. What I do know is that you and I bump into human suffering in front of us every day. And we're not called to sit back and wait on a day when He will wipe away every tear from every eye. We are to work at bringing the old order of things to an end, replaced by the new order we see in Jesus that began in His death and resurrection, so that He can return and wipe away every tear from every eye. So if you were coming tonight looking for a philosophical answer, remember what I shared last night? I think following Jesus becomes derailed when we treat it philosophically. You can see this in Christian history. The first Christians after the apostles died, if you read their writings, Clement, Ignatius, Polycarp, the Didache, if you read those early Christian documents, they weren't great theological treaties on what to believe and what not to believe. They were ethical works on how to live and how not to live. We've lost some of that in Protestantism as a result of the Reformation. This faith versus works debate, how many have heard that in religious circles before? We're so afraid of any instruction on how to live that we've thrown out the entire thing, many of us. Jesus is not giving us a difficult way to get to heaven, a bunch of rules to do in order to get to heaven. He's giving us a risky way to heal the world. He's not giving you no medical student graduates from 3.5-4 years of medical school and says, man, what a works trip. All they did for the last 4 years was just tell me how to do things. Tell me what to do. No, they look at all that instruction and how to do things properly, and they're excited about it because they're going out into the world to make the world a better place. Yes, Jesus is going to give you a list of things to do this week, but it's not a list of things to do to arrive at some post-mortem destination. It's a rock that when you find it in front of you, He's going to give you how to shave off this angle and how to fix this angle and how to alleviate human suffering. And that's what, see, in the early, this is where I was going with that, the early Christian writings, they were focused on what to do and what not to do. Not as a how to earn something, but as a way to bring alleviation to the suffering that they saw in their world. The turn of the century, especially with what's his name? Justin Martyr. Justin Martyr was the first Christian father to write. This is just trivia, but if you're into this, if you're into history, you'll love it. If you don't, you can just disregard it. Justin Martyr, go read his writings. He is the first Christian father, early Christian father, to not write about ethics, but he's debating with the Greek philosophers trying to explain the way the world works. And from that point on, you start to see something changing within the Jesus revolution. We began to be much more concerned with fixing what people believed about certain things rather than in being an active agent for alleviating human suffering in the world. And we're not immune to that today. How many have bumped into that reality in your own experience with religion and Christianity? People arguing over beliefs and sometimes forgetting that, yes, we have a spectrum of beliefs even here in this room tonight, don't we? But we can all agree on one thing: there's suffering in this world. And Jesus gave us a way to cooperate with one another where the collective is able to do greater than the individual. And we can go out into the world following the ethical teachings of this Jesus and bringing human suffering to an end. So again, if you came tonight looking for that Greek philosophical answer as to why there's human suffering, you're not going to find it in the Jesus story. You'll find things that guide you in understanding what the answer isn't. How many saw that tonight? But what you'll get from the Jesus story, more importantly, not an answer that will allow you to sit back satisfied that you've explained it, but a set of values, a set of ethics, that if put into practice will be difficult. They will be challenging. They will challenge us to our core. But the end goal is to bring the suffering of humanity to an end. Because the picture of God Jesus chose, out of all the pictures of God in the Old Testament that he could have chose to commemorate his ministry, he chose the picture of God in the beginning of Isaiah as God as the liberator of the poor, he who had come to set the oppressed free. And that's encouraging, amen? Whatever your oppression is, whether it's because of gender, race, economics, whatever it is, Jesus chose to portray a God whose primary activity in this world is liberation from oppression, all things that oppress. We're going to break for 15 minutes. We're making better time tonight, by the way. If you have questions, write them down. We will answer tonight's questions tomorrow night. Tonight we're going to spend some time answering some questions that came in from last night when we come back. Just a few things. Make sure tonight that you get your handout for the second half of the presentation, second half of the meetings tonight, the second presentation, second half of the evening. If you haven't had a chance to register, all we're asking is how you found out about this series so that we can be more efficient. One of the things that we believe in as far as Renewed Heart Ministries is not charging people money for anything. Jesus said, freely you've received, freely give. I have a philosophical problem charging people money for things that Jesus taught for free. How many can see the disconnect there? So even this weekend, I'm not making a red cent off of this. This is not how it works. It's not, I mean, people say, well, Herb, how are you going to make a living? Haven't figured that out yet. But it's all, you know, it's. We want to do things as freely as possible, as efficiently as possible, as devoid of the monetary system as possible. And so one of the things that helps us know how to do this more effectively is we want to know how you found out about this series. Why are you here tonight? If you would register and just tell us that, we will send you as our thank you. It's not if you come a certain amount of nights. It's just for giving us that information. At the end of this series, we will send you to whatever address you give us on that paper. We will send you a free copy of the entire series. It'll be an audio copy, not a visual, an audio copy of the entire series along with all the handouts just as a gift to you. It's about a $70 value. We're just giving that to you as a thank you. How many have ever been to series where they sell you the recordings every? How many have ever been to one of those? That's not what we're not here. We're not going to take your money this week. How many are thankful for that? We're not here to add more stress to your financial worries. But while we're asking, we're going to give it away for free if you would just tell us, help us in that one thing. The other thing is that there is a drawing tonight. Great. This author, I have not read this book, okay? But I know this author personally. And this guy is the real deal. You ever met people that are playing the game? This guy's the real deal. His name is Chris Blake. He is a professor at a Christian university called Union University in Nebraska. He's a peace worker from the 60s and 70s. In other words, he was an activist for nonviolence. And today he's leading peace and reconciliation work as a Christian. And one of the books that he's written is Searching for a God to Love. Just an exceptional guy. I got a chance to actually spend a weekend with him last month. Him and me and about 10 other people, we just spent the weekend together. And he's just such a cool guy. So anyways, this book is worth putting your name in the hat for. It's separate than the registration. Just write your name on a piece of paper, throw it in the bowl, and they'll have a drawing for this at the end. Again, I haven't read the book, but I know the guy, and he's a great guy. What else? There was a third thing. Oh, no, I said that. Questions, registration, drawing, handout. Am I missing anything? That's it? All right, good. Enjoy your refreshments. We'll be back in 15 minutes. Thank you so much for being here tonight. The next topic is repenting of religion. Come back in 15 minutes. We'll see you then.